history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty amazing stories out there that really ought to be told, and we're never going to hear them unless we take the time to ask the right questions and listen to what comes back our way. If we make that patient investment of time, we're going to end up learning a lot of things perhaps we didn't expect or never would have imagined. We're educated, we're entertained, so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, and when Mother's Day rolls around, it's always fun to shine the spotlight on the women of World War II. They contributed in so many different ways. In addition to the more than 350,000 women who were wearing U.S. Armed Forces uniforms during the war, there were millions more doing what they could to help. And we've heard many of their stories over the years here, from Rosie the Riveters in aircraft factories to USO performers, you're going to meet one of those in a bit, to the Coast Guard spars, the Navy waves, the Army WACs, the nurses who ended up in harm's way. And let's start with a little bit on a daring group of ladies who were flying whatever planes the military was let them climb into. The WASPs, Women Air Force Service Pilots. You've heard from a few of them over the years here, and you can pull up their audio memories online at hometownheroesradio.com. But this weekend's Mother's Day episode is really driven by daughters who want to honor their mothers. And I imagine there are a lot of you out there listening who don't have your mom around anymore. You'd love to go back in time and ask her questions about lots of things, maybe even what she did during World War II. And if that's you, Susan Hahn of Carson City, Nevada, knows how you feel. Her mother, Hazel, was one of the just over 1,000 American women who actually completed their WASP training during World War II. There were 38 of them who were killed in the line of duty while testing or ferrying airplanes to deliver them to the men who would fly them in combat. We're going to hear from Susan briefly about her mom's legacy before we meet a spirited 91-year-old former USO dancer and her daughter. So Susan, I know the WASPs were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in 2009, but it wasn't until after that that you started to dig into your mom's legacy. So when was that that your interest in this started to take off?
Not until about 2010 or so, when I started to realize all that she did and accomplished as such a young person in difficult times.
She'd been gone for a few years by then. So growing up, did you ever hear stories about her flying or see her flight goggles or hear what a WASP was?
I did, but I didn't really comprehend the historical nature of it. Growing up, hearing about it all the time, it rather was a little bit boring for a child, so I didn't comprehend it really, and my interest as a young child were playtime. But it wasn't until much later that I understood how extraordinary these women were and what they accomplished in that day and age, when that was completely unheard of for women in that time.
Well, and I'm just thinking there's probably a lot of people listening right now who are in the same boat who say, man, I wish I had my mom or dad back to ask them these questions because I didn't get it back then, or I didn't even know the depth of this history. So what was it that lit that spark for you, that sparked your interest in her experience as a WASP?
Really, it was reading her manuscript and the journal of her days, and really began to understand what not only she went through, but what those women went through. The controversy they faced, the hurdles that they had to overcome, not only being discriminated against by men, but probably people in the nation, thinking that women weren't capable of that, and really coming to understand her courage in the face of such a conflicting time and the discrimination that they faced, and how she and those all the other women just fought their way through to fulfill their dreams.
So you mentioned this manuscript. A lot of people will stumble across their parents' belongings, and sometimes they just get thrown in the trash heap. What was it that you saw that said, hey, this is something interesting, this is worth digging a little deeper on?
It made me understand who she was, because she was a person of great courage and determination, during a time when it would have been much easier and would have made everyone around her much happier to just comply with the norm, for her to stand up and fight for what she wants and to fulfill her dreams was inspiring.
Do I hear a hint of you looked at her experiences and what she had written down and you imagined yourself in her shoes and living during that time period, and what would you have done?
I'd like to think that. I have faced my own issues and controversy in my time, and I believe that the courage that I've gained came from her.
So tell us a little bit about her. What have you been able to learn about what she did and how she accomplished what she accomplished?
She was determined to fulfill her dreams and continue with the things that she's passionate about. From a very early age, she was very passionate about aviation and determined to fly. She never stopped finding some way to be involved, whether it was just writing about it, or she was part of the EAA, which is Experimental Aircraft Association, helped begin the chapter in Carson City, and was very active in that and just continued in that area no matter what.
And in your mind, not having lived through it, but educating yourself because of your mom's story, what was it that made the WASPs so significant?
I think just given the, especially the time period, these women faced a lot of hurdles and discrimination and were constantly told that they couldn't do it, constantly told that they were incapable of flying and just doing anything associated that male pilots should be doing or were doing. And they proved them wrong and set the path for future women after them.
So you have here your mom's actual flight goggles that she wore when she was a WASP. When you hold those in your hand and you feel them, you examine them, what comes to mind for you? Do you picture your mom in the cockpit of one of those planes? Do you imagine flying like she did? What is it that comes to mind?
Yes, I do. And I also hope that maybe I honored her back in 2015, I believe it was, when the Collins Foundation brought to the Minden Airport a set of World War II planes. And I took flight in the B-29 with her goggles with me and took her spirit for a flight. She lived in an extraordinary time of change and was very much a part of history and paved the way for many women out there, not only to fulfill their dreams and to pursue them relentlessly, but also to stand up for what is right.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think it sounds like maybe learning more about your mother and what she went through changed your perspective a little bit, gave you a new view on your own life or our world today?
Yes, it did. She and I, we didn't have the best relationship. There were many years between us. She was 45 when she had me, so it was very difficult. But so I didn't really learn more about her until after her death. And I wish that I had the chance to get to know who she was. I'm just grateful that she left behind information about herself for me to know who she was.
Have you ever wondered how it would be different if you had maybe seen that manuscript and decided not to open it up?
Yes, it would be very different. I wouldn't know her, and I would not have understood her. And through reading her manuscript, I've come to understand myself better as well.
Well, and maybe there's a powerful reminder there for the rest of us. Sometimes, even if our loved ones aren't here anymore, getting to know and understand a little bit about what they did during this pivotal time in our nation's history may lead us toward lessons we never knew we were going to learn. So that was Susan Hahn of Carson City, Nevada, talking about her late mother, Hazel. You can find photos of mother and daughter at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also learn about 91-year-old Joan Patron. Her daughter, Anna, is a loyal Hometown Heroes listener on affiliate KNZR in Bakersfield, California, and she encouraged me to come meet her mom and explore her adventure during World War II as a teenage USO dancer in Europe and Japan. I figured, hey, Mother's Day weekend would be the perfect opportunity, but as is the case with all these amazing Americans we meet on Hometown Heroes, we never know where the conversation might lead. I hope you're ready for a candid, real conversation with a veteran of stage and screen whose life and perspective were forever altered by what she witnessed at the end of World War II. Let's get to know a little bit about Joan Patrone. 91 years old, is that really the truth? Because you don't look 91.
I've been told that. I don't know what to say, but if people doubt it, I offer them to look at my license, and some of them do, and if they don't believe that, I do a Charleston for them, a dance.
So you're going to do a Charleston for me before we leave today?
Well, this is the radio. They wouldn't be able to see it. The viewer wouldn't be. They'd only be able to imagine it.
Well, that's why we have hometownheroesradio.com and the Facebook page. So if you do the Charleston and I video it, they can all see it, and they can see it to believe it.
It's very short. It's about a minute long. So if you're interested, I'm willing to do it. But we don't have to do it. It'd make a nice addition to the interview. But
would it top Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed and It's a Wonderful Life? Uh-huh. Wasn't that a Charleston they were doing?
I don't remember that.
Or was it the Jitterbug? And am I really talking to a Jitterbug champion?
The Charleston was before my time, probably even before I was born, maybe. But the jitterbugging was entirely different. I won some jitterbug contests when I was young. I want to remind you that I'm from Long Island, and it is an island in the Atlantic. And I was really raised, unbeknownst to most people, they don't think of themselves as natives. I was a primitive, because I can remember going with my relatives on a boat, and they said, okay, now you get out and you put your feet in the sand and you sink a little bit and you feel for the clams, you bend over and pick up the clams and put them in this bucket. And I did so, but as I got in the mud, I got hysterical because I just kept sinking, and I thought, I'm just going to continue to sink. These people don't know what they're doing. You know, even though I saw others doing it, I felt like I was not going to be able to stop the sinking. Mm-hmm. So I did a little bit of it, but I did experience what it's like to be very close to nature, and your food sources were from planet Earth, farming and fishing and stuff. And we used to go to Jones Beach, and the beach was beautiful, white sands, and it was a wonderful life there as a primitive. So then in high school, it was like a utopia. It was so wonderful. There was nothing ever went wrong. Everything always went right. And then I became 17, and I think I picked up a newspaper in front of the house that wasn't ours, and I looked through it, and it said, USO Dancers Wanted. And I thought, hey, that sounds like great. You know, this town is small, and I'm growing out of it. It's a small town, and it's getting a bit boring. You know, I'd like to see the world, and this is an opportunity. I could go to France, Germany, and Japan. Wow! So I went, and I was chosen, and I found myself on a boat.
Let me come back to that, because I want to give a little context and background here. First of all, I mean, you're growing up as the middle child out of five, so you've got a couple brothers and a couple sisters. Do you remember having an idea, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do, here's what I'm going to be, this is what I'm going to spend my life chasing?
The first memory I have of being in front of an audience was when I was 3 years old. I had a little umbrella, and I was hiding behind it on stage. I was told to look to the right, look to the left, look over it, and pick up and do a little twirl, and I did that. And the audience went, I saw the faces. It was like a tapestry. It was sort of all these dark colors and light colors mixed with, you know, it was beautiful. And when they saw me, they said, oh, I could hear this big sigh, and I thought, oh, that they like me. That is what I can remember. Then when I went to my mother and said, how did you get me on stage at three? And she said, she didn't know how to answer it really. She just, off the top of her head, she said, well, you were afraid of your father. So he was programming me, and I'm sure that I don't remember the discipline. I don't remember him being cruel to me, but he was programming me to be an entertainer. I acquired some wonderful skills that I really appreciate, but it wasn't my choice. I was not allowed to choose my career. So I went with it. It had its bumps in the dark and so forth, like everybody's life. We all have obstacles to overcome along the way.
Looking back, do you think you would have chosen something different if you had been able to choose?
Yes, I think I would have liked to have been a doctor.
Well, I'm curious. You're there. You know, you're a young teenager, maybe 14 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember that day and how you heard?
I came from a poor, struggling family because my father left my mother with five kids and her mother. So we struggled. We were hurting for food. I can remember not caring, but I think I had two pairs of socks for years. I had the same socks. I'd wash them and sew them if they were got holes in them. So we were struggling, and we were poor. And I used to pick beans for my mother to help with the money, and then I think she went on relief. But in high school, it was euphoric. I was happy. I was a cheerleader, captain. I was a captain of our teams, hockey and volleyball. They didn't have a drama course, so I asked the principal if they were going to have one. He said no, so I made up my own skits and performed anyway and sang. I was so busy, I didn't have time to be miserable. However, there was something. The only communication I had with the outside world was a little box that we used to sit in front of. It was called a radio. And we would listen to Hi-Yo Silver, the Lone Ranger. We'd listen to Jack Benny and things like that. And we would sit there and imagine what it was like, but the visuals. But that was the only, I never heard one thing ever that I can remember. And it may have just slipped by me as not being important. Didn't know that Hitler was trying to conquer the world. Didn't know that he was killing millions for his own self-glorification. I didn't know about the war being over, except when 1945 came, I was going to go on this boat trip to, it was like, I didn't have the awareness that I have now.
What about when your brother joined the service? Was that hard to see your brother going off to war?
No, there was no talking about it, no last dinner together, nothing. He went off to Florida. I went off to France and Germany. We just did things. There wasn't much communication about it that I can remember. It was just things are happening. That was what my impression was.
So when you saw that Help Wanted ad for USO dancers, the whole idea is you guys go overseas, you entertain the troops who have been risking their lives and many of them wounded, have been through all these horrible things, and you try to brighten their day a little bit, right? What was your understanding of what you were going over there to do?
I told you it was a personal adventure. It was like, we're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. It was an adventure. And I would observe and absorb and learn as I went. I was trying to figure out what my life was all about. What was my purpose? I didn't have any. I just was like everybody else. Sometimes I think of us all as being astronauts on planet Earth without the spacesuits, that we're all on this little ball, and the gravity keeps us all tight together. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I'm not afraid to tell you what my imagination is like.
I'm sure you just made a few people think about it.
Yeah. People are afraid to talk about their inner nature because it's pretty scary in there. I just kept going through life as I said before, like a cat. I was very curious to see what it was all about, just like you did, everybody else. It is a journey.
Well, and I'm sure you had no idea what that journey was going to be like
when
you set out as a teenager from the East Coast and you head to Europe where there's been a war going on for years here. So what did you see over there and what did you do?
I was on this transport and it seemed dangerous because the waves were very high crossing the Atlantic. I could stand against the wind and it would hold me up. It was fun, Then we landed and we weren't briefed about what it was like, which I felt was lacking in, they should have cared more. I found myself in a truck going through a bombed city with the rubble, and then it was kind of smelly, we didn't know what was going on. Somebody would get a handkerchief because those people are dead under the buildings. And so the rubble was their gravestone above the earth. So suddenly I was transported from a state of, a utopian, happy little kid, having a wonderful time. Everything was great, and now I was put in this environment of this dark, hellish rubble, the insanity of killing people for what war zone. And it was shocking. It was like from night into day, into this tsunami of evil that was in force. It was all, everything was insane and crazy and killing and starving and no anything. Food was hard to get, or electricity, or thing. People were being killed. And sudden, it was all like, and I wasn't there with a soldier with a rifle. I was just there with my, my dancing shoes. So I began to become very cautious. Oh, okay, so I'm here to entertain the troops. That's it.
So it sounds like that was kind of overwhelming for you.
It was very overwhelming. I didn't know even then that it was overwhelming. So I don't feel that what I was doing was heroic. And if I was being heroic, I wasn't consciously doing it. I was just being part of it.
And remember, she was an 18-year-old kid who, like many of those young men she was there to entertain, was not prepared to see, to smell, to hear, to understand the devastation of war. It's time for our first break, but we'll have more with 91-year-old Joan Patrone when we come back. The haunting scene she witnessed in Hiroshima with the first USO troop to visit there after the war. How she reacted in that moment and why she still has strong feelings about it now. We'll also hear about her long friendship with actor Marlon Brando. Check out the photos and a short video I know you're going to love at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking Mother's Day weekend by getting to know an energetic 91-year-old mom whose contribution to the war effort 7 decades ago was to entertain the troops overseas. Starting in France and Germany, Joan Patrone was an 18-year-old dancing for the USO.
They loved us, and it was a condensed version of a musical on Broadway, Panama Hattie. We had rehearsed it, and we did it, and they loved it. They were very appreciative, and we began to feel that maybe we were doing something helpful and good for the morale.
So until you saw the troops and their response and what it meant to them, you didn't really understand the importance of what you're doing?
Exactly, yes.
And what was your role in the show?
I was a professional dancer. I don't like the term chorus girl. I was a dancer in it. And, you know, sometimes you get special little things to do, special that are outside of just the chorus, you know. It was, we were being paid. I was sending my money home to my mother, who needed it for the younger kids left, my grandmother. That was where I was really doing some good, was sending money home to my mother. That was a perk. I loved the fact that I was getting 3 meals a day. I said, wow, this is terrific. I'm going to get so healthy and, you know. It wasn't hard work. And we weren't allowed to date lieutenants and above. We were only allowed to date the enlisted men. When I was coming back from Japan, a lieutenant came up to me. I hadn't even met him. I don't even remember his name, except that he was very handsome. He looked like Gregory Peck. And when he saw us leaving, he came up to me and said, will you marry me? I thought, oh my God, I don't even know him. That was scary. It was scary. It was so, you know, I knew nothing. And I said, oh no, I'm only 18. I'm not thinking about marriage right now. I didn't want to insult him and say, you know, what, are you crazy or something? But that happened. And we dated. And some of the women were breaking the rules. They were dating pilots and they were dating lieutenants and things. And even the servicemen knew they weren't supposed to date us, and they would date us. The rules were always being broken.
You mentioned those first things you saw, and even the smell of dead, decaying bodies and how assaulting that was to your senses. What else did you see and experience there, and how did that add to your understanding of what was really happening and what these young men were going through?
Well, you may not believe this, but I didn't know. I didn't even know that Hitler was killing the Jews. I didn't know that he wanted to conquer the world. I didn't know that he was a satanic soul, that he was a victim of his hate. He was a monster. But I didn't know all of that. I just knew Germany was in war and they lost the war. That was it. And here's the result. And it's pretty awful. It's horrific. But when I went on that boat, merrily, 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 life is but a dream, you know, row, row, row your boat. It was a transport that took me there. It wasn't merrily, 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 life is but a dream there. It was a nightmare. So I had rowed myself into into a nightmare. Yeah.
At 18 years old.
Yeah. So I was, as I told you, I was part shock absorber, part curious cat, and just going through the minefields of life. You know, I mean, I didn't know what was going to happen next. With my life, except that I went to Japan. I said, okay, yeah. Okay, I'm going there too.
You're 18. A lot of these soldiers are 18, 19, 20 years old. Did you form an impression of them?
I knew that they were soldiers. I had no idea what it's like to be a soldier in combat until I saw films, fantastic films that were made about what war was really like. Those images never entered my mind, that these men were putting their lives and their guts, their soul into that they had to face death maybe any day. I never thought about that. I just thought, oh, it's an audience. You're here to entertain. Just do your job. Be a good girl. You're here to witness. I really did feel consciously like a witness, that I was witnessing all of this, that I wasn't really, I was a part of it. Whatever part it was to entertain, that was my job. But I never went into the depth of the evil force that was hovering over people at this time in history. There was an evil force worse coming up, which was the atomic bomb. And I didn't know about that either. You know, nobody knew about that one.
Truman didn't even know until FDR died. So you go throughout France and Germany performing for all these troops. The war has just ended. They're relieved. They're happy to see you. And then they ask you if you want to go to Japan too?
Yeah, I was eager to find out what that was like. And I found myself in an airplane this time, not a boat. I remembered this much of the airplane inside. It was a bucket seat. It's like a swing when you're a kid and it's, you know, you're buckled in and so you sit there. And then I said, well, I'm on my way to Japan. And then we landed. We were on our way on a train to a station. Oh, this was a variety show. This was different. I was jitterbugging with another dancer. So I did other things. I can't remember. We danced and skits and stuff. So I got off the train with some other dancers. All together, there were about four of us. And the first thing I saw was a skeleton of a big building with nothing, no walls. It was transparent, just the iron structure. That was shocking to me because it wasn't a normal look. You know, it wasn't, there was no building. I said, oh my God, just evaporate. It just vaporized the inside of everything. And that to me was horrible. And I thought, my God, I'm sure other things happened that were worse than that. So we walked a little way, take some fresh air and walk around. And the only thing for acres of land, the only thing that we came upon was a tiny little white rubble, almost like a dome with a bell. This is the first time that I protested, you know, making my statement about a policy or about war. It was the first time that I objected, and it was my own country that I was objecting. I said, oh, this is terrible. We shouldn't be using atomic bombs on people. I knew that Hiroshima had been bombed. So I found myself looking at this rubble, and there was the bell, and there was a long rope that came down through on top of the rubble down right to my feet. It almost became a live thing, because how could I resist taking the rope? I bent down. I was not thinking anymore. I was just feeling. It was emotional. My anger. I took that rope and I just blang, 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 just made as much noise as I possibly could with that. And I thought, oh, people are hearing this. They know what this is. It's a protest. Wherever they are, they must be in the woods over there in houses and things. They must hear this. And that was the first time I thought, later, many years later, I said, your voice, you were expressing, you had a voice with the bell.
The protest was in response to the unbelievable loss of life that the atomic bomb had brought to Hiroshima.
I could only imagine what it must have been. I knew that the fact that things disappeared, I didn't even know that it was fire and burning and a toxic rain and a burning of skin. I didn't even think of that. I just saw what happened to the building, and I thought, oh, my God, what about the people? They disappeared with it. Just a skeleton of a building. I thought, okay, so now it gets worse. Before it was rubble, now it's making cities invisible, t- total destruction.
You know, we've heard on this program from quite a few veterans of World War II who were slated to invade Japan and were on their way to do so. And their feeling is, you know, those atomic bombs saved my life. My life was spared because they dropped that bomb. And I don't hear you arguing with that, but you're saying there were still lives lost, and that's tragic.
Right. There's the other side of the coin where innocent people were killed. Children, babies, their skin falling off their bodies while they're trying to get help, and there isn't any help there. It's pretty horrific. I mean, look, the only thing that I learned in my 91 years is that I wish that as a child I had been taught that there is such a thing as an evil force. It exists, it's there, and it can get into the human soul if you let it. Like Hitler did. He allowed the satanic hate to take him over. It was overwhelming, and it overwhelmed him. It took his life, too. His hate took his life, too. The hate said, oh, you're next. You have to commit suicide now, and you're in a rat hole, and you're done. You're finished. We're finished with you. There is a hate force, and there is also a good force. There's evil and good in this world. It is. It exists. It's reality. So when you are experiencing this along the way, if you don't learn that there is evil and good, I didn't hear the word evil at all ever in my childhood, anywhere. People said, oh, that's bad, that's wrong. But I never heard the word evil until I was a mature adult. And even then, I hardly heard it, even in church. So then I was also trying to find out what was going to hold me together. And the thing that held me together is Sermon on the Mount.
What was it about that spoke to you, that helped you deal? Because it sounds like that was traumatic for you to see this devastation in Hiroshima.
I never expected the world to be like that.
You said that that the Sermon on the Mount held you together.
Yes.
Was there something specifically that you read or heard there that applied to the situation you found yourself in, or maybe the uncertainty you were feeling?
Yes. The only thing that worked for me was that the truth is my best friend. Christ said, the truth will set you free. And also, be as a child again. I thought he was saying, be as a child again, meaning be innocent again. He also said, live in this world, but be not of this world. And I was washing dishes one day, and I thought of that. And I thought, live in this world, but be not of this world, came to my mind. And I said, how that? I actually thought I could ask him. And said, how am I supposed to do that? Well, the answer didn't come right away, but it did come. And I heard this message, detach from evil.
And I guess the other thing that comes to mind, and I don't want to leave anything out as far as World War II, but you said that at the time, and again, you're a teenager. I mean, how much do you understand as a teenager, that you were out there for an adventure? Has that perspective changed over the years? Because I think even though we still have entertainers who go and entertain the troops around the world, it just seems to me that during this era, it was the brightest stars. If they weren't in the service themselves, and many of them were. I mean, guys like Clark Gable were wearing Army Air Corps uniforms. Mm. But Bob Hope,
yes,
and Jack Benny,
yes,
and Fred,
yes,
Astaire, they're all entertaining the troops.
Yes, I felt a little kind of attachment or part of that, too. I thought, oh, I did that, too, you know. But I didn't think of myself as doing something great. The only time that I felt that I was doing something right and good was ringing the bell. Ringing the bell in protest. That was my contribution. A little teeny-weeny little sound, you know, like Horton Hears a Who. I mean, if you're up in the universe and you're on the moon, you know, certainly not going to... I'm invisible if you're on the moon and you don't hear it. It was a little teeny-weeny sound in the universe. A little beep, you know, saying, no, this is wrong. War is hell. It's evil. It's bad. It's no good. We're not supposed to be doing this.
Now, I want to hear a little more about your career in show business, because we could be here all day talking about that, I'm sure. But on the war, I talked to veterans who have experienced post-traumatic stress,
yes,
and still do, 70
yes,
years after World War II.
Yes.
And I understand that's something that you,
yes,
dealt with because,
yes,
of what you saw in Japan.
I think so. I think that I saw, I didn't see evil a little at a time. I saw it all at once, and my brain wouldn't wrap around it. It just kept saying, what is this? What does this mean to you? What does this mean? What is your future like? What are you going to do? I think that I probably felt isolated, but I also realize that I didn't have a stable frame of reference as far as nutrition was concerned. And so I think I was malnourished also, besides being shocked and so forth. So I was, you know, defeated by a lot of things that I didn't know why. when you start having hallucinations or you can't cope, you can't function, that's a sign that something's wrong. What happened was that I had what is known as, they call it a nervous breakdown. The solution was you have to go to a mental institution. And I find, here I am, and, you know, in a mental institution with bars, and you have to take this medication. Medication was made me dizzy, non-functional. I would have to pass out a little or nap or something. So I wouldn't take it. I would, you know, I would rather cope with what was going on. It did probably stop hallucinations and things. But anyway, they gave me 10 shock treatments, and it was horrible. I mean, this was, what are you doing to me? Why? What have I done? Somebody asked me to join Network Against Psychiatric Assault, and I said, what's that? And I said, well, anybody that's had shock treatments actually, you know, it's an assault on your, you know, not guaranteeing that you will come out of it. You could have a heart attack. You could have, you know, they're taking away certain rights that you have to refuse. In other words, if you say, I don't want shock treatments, you shouldn't be able to have to have them. So it was a forceful thing that they were against. Not giving you a choice. So I said, right, they were terrible. That was horrible. They were awful. So I would go on a little short tour in a little neighborhood or something explaining what it was like to go under shock treatments. I felt I was doing a service to people that they should know what a shock treatment was.
Is it true that you're the one who brought this to Jack Nicholson's attention?
Oh, yes,
and that's why he's starting that movie?
Yeah. That's a riot. I was working for Marlon Brando as an assistant, one of his assistants. Jack Nicholson was living just down the block on this hill. We call it a block. It was a path down to his residence, and I never met him. But he had an assistant, and I went to her one day, and I said, I didn't show her the book. I said, I have a book. It's called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's got an Academy Award winning role in here for Jack. And I said, I'd like to meet him and give him this. And she said, no, you know, it's like sandbox politics, right? You know, you really would like to see this done. It's personal. Another ringing the bell. So I said, just why don't we do this? You tell me, how do you get a screenplay produced? And I knew you had to go to a producer, but I pretended that, you know, I'll exchange it so I wouldn't have to belly up to her. You know, we'll exchange, you know. So I said, here's the book. Well, my God, 2 years later, 2 years, I was sitting watching the Academy Awards, and Jack Nicholson is waving this Oscar. And I thought, that's not possible. I never even met him. What's going on? I never heard, hey, it's going to be done. You know, I did, at the last minute, I did hear a little bit. I told a friend, he got into the movie. I told a friend that it was going. So I met her in a shop one day, and I said, hey, I never asked you, what did you think of my predicting that there was a role in there, actors, an Academy Award role for Jack Nicholson. She said, oh, well, you were psychic. I said, oh.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's break time again, but you heard Joan mention another famous name in there, Marlon Brando, with whom she would act in the 1961 Western he directed, One-Eyed Jacks. We'll explore their friendship when we come back and also hear from Joan's daughter. A special Mother's Day edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHSmaster will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 91-year-old Joan Patrone of Bakersfield, California, originally from Long Island, New York, an accomplished dancer, actress, instructor, someone who's carried out so many roles in the entertainment industry, and as you've heard, also someone who feels strongly that the use of nuclear weapons should be avoided at all costs. Witnessing the devastation of Hiroshima as an 18-year-old is something that she would later pinpoint as the source of post-traumatic stress disorder. This has been a different kind of conversation today from what we usually hear on Hometown Heroes, but it certainly underscores the reality that World War II was a period that altered not just the course of our nation and the world, but the lives of everyone who survived it. Let's learn a little more about where Joan's journey headed after the war. She was in the very first musical production of Guys and Dolls, and over time kept adding more and more acting to her dancing.
I became an actress, and in California, I appeared on the Perry Mason Show and gave the best performance that I ever experienced. I knew that I was giving a very good performance and that I was now in a series that a star had taken a role in, not in the same episode that I was in, but Bette Davis was also invited to do Perry Mason's series. So I was, my status, my self-esteem went up a little bit, and I thought, oh boy, this is terrific, and I'm on my way to becoming maybe a good actress, and I could make a living at it. You know, that was supposed to be a step up, and then they invited me back for a second. Then when I arrived in California, I went through the same thing that the Me Too Weinstein thing went, so I quit. I couldn't go to the next level because I simply couldn't do what they asked me to do.
Well, and hats off to you for having the willpower and the character to withstand that pressure. You mentioned a name there, Marlon Brando.
Oh, yes.
And I understand he wanted to serve in the Army in World War II but had a football injury and they ruled him 4F, so he never could. But how did you come to know the guy who everybody does an impersonation of? Do you have a Marlon Brando impersonation, by the way?
No, I don't. But I do. I had a 50-year friendship with him. He saw me in a reporter, a New York reporter who had a column, introduced me to him. As I came out, I met this reporter. As I came out, he introduced me to Marlon. And I don't know whether he asked to meet me because he saw the show and he liked me. There were so many women. I don't know what happened. But he said, oh, you know, hi, Tony. You know, this is Marlon. Marlon, this is Tony. And Marlon put up his, the first thing he did was look at me. He put up his fists. So evidently his impression was that I was a little toughy. So I was a mime. I still am a mime. You know, I have mime skills. So I put up my fists in a position of a lightweight fighter. And I felt funny. I thought, how stupid this is. This is, but it's playful. And I thought, he's different. Isn't that interesting? You know, well, we ended up dating. I didn't know that he had a few mistresses going on at the time. He was very secretive. We had a wonderful relationship. It was very friendly and understanding. We had both had pretty tough childhoods. So there was an understanding and a friendship. And our sense of humor would sometimes blend because of that. Because we had a lot in common because our childhoods were... my father was an alcoholic, but we didn't know that he was. And his mother was an alcoholic. So, and he thought that I was a good actress. And I think he wanted me on his side for some reason. I don't know. Among women, we were called conduits to his talent. Like he would plug into certain aspects of our personality and also what we had accomplished in, you know, oh, you were in Guys and Dolls? Oh, really? So he became, you know, before you know it, he's in Guys and Dolls, the movie. And he had a mistress that was in Tahiti, and he had children with her. He ended up doing Mutiny on the Bounty. So these women became somehow conduits for his projects. I don't know how that is done. I mean, you know, is it done in a laboratory? How do you take a woman and then say, oh, you were in that? Well, I'm going to do the movie of that. Was it a conquering thing? Was it a competitive thing? I don't know. Oh, you were in A Mutiny on the Bounty with Clark Gable? I'm going to do the movie now. I'm going to do a rerun of it. He was a very gifted actor. So he would mesmerize people. Personally, in the movies, he was fabulous. He was a phenomenon of nature. He was gifted with a great skill. He could imitate anything. And he would utilize that ability to absorb the essence of somebody and then incorporate it into his performance. I mean, you would see a different costume, maybe playing Napoleon, but he might be doing some other actor's voice. He would listen to it for hours and then imitate Claude Rains for Napoleon. This is what he did. He did things like, and that was very specific. You know, his mother had been an actress. As a child, he was raised watching the plays, the summer stock plays, and he was like a father to me at times that I didn't have. And so he put me in his pocket. So over a 50-year period that was an on and off again friendship, And when he needed me, he would call me.
Here's one question about Brando. And I guess if he could take on anyone's personality and impersonate anyone, then he couldn't be offended that people are always going around saying, I could have been a contender, or, you know, all the Godfather quotes, right?
Oh, I told him that that's what they were going to do. He asked me to come to see his movie, Streetcar Named Desire. He invited me and wanted to know. Well, I was so overwhelmed with his performance. He was sitting right next to me, and I said, oh, who just hit him? What? Why did they hit him? He's sitting right here, and I'm talking about him. I felt so foolish. But anyway, out after that, he said, what did you think of my performance? He wanted my opinion. Yeah. I was overwhelmed. I thought, I have an opinion that's important to this genius? So I said, well, I don't think you're going to get an award for this one, which he didn't. I said, but it was powerful. But you are a character lead actor, which is very unusual. And I said, your performance was fantastic. I said, you know what's going to happen? People are going to imitate you all the time, like they do James Cagney, and the way they imitate Bela Lugosi, or how they imitate, you know, or any Clark Abel. They're going to do that. They're going to imitate you.
And they still are.
And they still are. And I said, it was fantastic. But I did predict that he would not win the award then, but he would in the future win. I knew that he would win.
And I know you worked closely with him for decades. You had a relationship with him, yes, and all those things. A lot has been said and written about him. Is there anything that you think people should know about who he really was, maybe that they wouldn't expect?
Well, first of all, I would say that he was a genius in his field, and that I don't think he knew that he was a genius. He was a phenomenon of nature, is what I think. He was a genius, but his personal life, his film life and his personal life were like night and day. He was very funny. I mean, you know, you'd fall on the floor laughing. But sometimes his jokes were kind of, you know, off color. To me, he was he could be remembered as conscientious about the underdog. He wanted to always protect and help the underdog, or people that were being abused. He would pick up and fight for them, you know, if he thought the American Indian, he was there. You know, he had me do research on the American Indians. But one thing that he didn't have were parental skills, because he didn't have them. His father didn't have, his mother didn't have. There was nothing for him either. His frame of reference about how to raise a family was, there wasn't anything there. He had to just guess.
Time has gone by fast on us, and I want to get some comments from your daughter. But I did see a photo here from just a couple years ago. You had a little reunion with the USO and got to hang out with some current day USO performers.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? I mean, that's 70 years later.
I was very impressed. They were so talented. The singing and the farcical comments in their dance character, the dancing had changed. They were doing character acting in their dancing. The chorus had improved. In other words, it had been raised to a different level. You had to really know how to sing, how to dance, how to create a character. So they were very talented.
And did you feel honored to be recognized that way?
Well, I wasn't dancing. I was just introducing them and saying how wonderful they were.
Well, and the reason they wanted you there is because you did what they did 70 years ago.
Yeah, I know. I didn't want to tell them because I thought, well, they're going to crunch the numbers and find out how old I am. Oh, gosh, you know, okay. I think that I'm still childish at times, very childish. That's not to my advantage.
Well, it's not to any of our advantage, but I think we all deal with that from time to time. I just have two more questions for you. One of them, what are you most proud of?
That I managed to get through hell and back. Wasn't easy. I don't know why I'm crying. See, I can't even tell you. That you touched me with that question. What am I proud of? And I did everything I could to be a good person. And I dared to take the inner journey to find out what I did with my life, or what I had to do with my life. And I had made decisions that didn't turn out right. But I can forgive myself, because you can't be responsible for somebody who you are not anymore, because you are always new. So I'm proud that I learn how to accept the truth, because the truth is my best friend. That is what carries me. I have a beautiful daughter. She has a wonderful sense of humor. She has a heart of gold. She can be feisty just like everybody else, and she can be demanding at times, and so am I, so are you. So everybody becomes demanding, or she can be very understanding, very loving, very thoughtful.
And it was her daughter Anna's thought, her idea, to let me know about Joan and her experience and bring that unique perspective to you on the radio today. So I'm trusting that Anna can bring this Mother's Day edition of Hometown Heroes to a fitting conclusion.
Oh, I love my mom. She's a survivor. She's creative and always strives for good, even though she's had, you know, a tough life. A lot of people don't really understand PTSD. And it's been difficult, but, you know, she got through it. And out of that came some very important, I don't know the word, but like standing up for like her work with the NOW organization and still striving to be creative and have a family, even though she had a lot of pain and struggled with some demons. And it actually got her closer to God because she's a spiritual seeker. I think taking a civilian and putting them in a war situation is beyond comprehension. And, you know, they've learned about PTSD and how it really affects people their whole life. I know she's proud to have been in the USO and that she does love the United States, but she doesn't like war. And there's a big difference. To understand that, I think, is important. But yeah, she's been quite a mom. It's been a lot of fun. And she doesn't look 91. And you know, big proponent of nutrition and health and vitamins. But yeah, we love this country and we appreciate everything that you do to tell the stories, because there's a lot of them and it's all good. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And you know, with regard to what she was doing in the USO, and I know you've heard a lot of the stories of a lot of the veterans that talked to me on this show or that went through what they did in World War II. To know that your mom was over there dancing for them and entertaining them and giving them a sense of the life that they couldn't get back to because they were stuck overseas, does that give you a sense of pride or connection to what your mom was doing back there?
Yeah, actually, you know, it takes a lot of guts to come from a small farm town and try to get $300 a month to help support your family and then just plunk yourself on a cargo boat and go on a six-month tour, 2 months in Mannheim, Germany, 2 months in Le Havre, France, and Hiroshima. And she was actually in the first entertainment civilian troop to go to Hiroshima, and we had done some research with the Hiroshima Memorial Peace Museum, and that was verified by the director, and she had submitted her plea for peace, which is the story about the bell, for the 70th anniversary of the bombing. And what most people don't know is that Hiroshima is actually built on the bodies of the dead from that experience. They actually detonated the bomb midair. It never really hit the ground, but it was the shockwave that blasted the city. And the Japanese didn't even know what was happening either, because the Japanese military held it as a secret. They knew that the second wave of bombers were coming, and they didn't inform the civilians. They could have evacuated, and they didn't, and they lost 80,000 people. So, I mean, it's a difficult subject because there's two sides to the story. The good news is that we have peace, and I think really what my mom is a proponent of peace, seeking peace, and that's really what we want. And also, no more nuclear bombs. It's just too much. It will destroy the planet, and we don't want that. We just want to learn to love, and I think that's what my mom means when she says, you know, against evil, which is hate. Let's just sit down and talk about it. Yeah, and then from there, we launch into Hollywood, and that's a whole other story. So,
which one is more destructive?
It's all had perspective, right? So we do come from a long line of military enthusiasts. My uncle was Joseph Petrone. He was a master sergeant. He developed the braking system for planes on the aircraft carrier so they didn't go off the end of the boat. My aunt Lucille and my cousin Barbara both worked in the military for Rockwell, I think it was. And my uncle Rocco Petrone was the director of the Marshall Flight Center and the NASA Apollo program. So we are a very committed pro-American military family, but you know, there's another side to that too. And so it was nice to talk about that today too, because the PTSD that my mother has suffered and that my father suffered when he was in Korea has really had difficulties on us kids having to navigate caring for parents who lose it sometimes and hold it together. But it's still the greatest country in the world, and I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. And I have been to Japan. I did go to Japan, and it was a healing experience for me to be there. So yeah, let's just all love each other, especially on Mother's Day. I love my mom.
That's Anna Bird talking about her mother, Joan Patrone, who, yes, really is 91. And remember when we introduced her, what she said her ultimate response is when people doubt that age? She said she dances the Charleston. And yes, we do have the video evidence of just how light on her feet she is at 91 on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and at hometownheroesradio.com. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there, including my mom, Linda, a one-time Army nurse. That's our program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.